This is Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for spending some of your day with us. The word permaculture has been getting a lot of buzz lately, including here on the show. Well, today we're going to take a look at how it can relate to your own backyard. And our guest is Brandy Hall. She is the founder and CEO of Shades of Green Permaculture. She has 2 decades of experience in building off-grid water systems, landscape construction, and integrated farming systems. And she speaks at a variety of public engagements, from community events to conferences. And Brandy also serves as the mayor for the city of Pine Lake, Georgia. Do you garden with biodiversity in mind? Have you thought about water cycle in your landscape? What questions do you have about regenerative gardening? Join in by calling 800-642-1234. Or, of course, you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Brandy, thank you so much for being with us today. I think that you're probably the first ever mayor to ever grace the airwaves of Garden Talk.
Well, so much for having me.
You bet. We'll be sending you a certificate. It'll be in the mail.
Awesome. Great. I'll put it on my wall.
Thank you. So in, you know, your job as mayor and as a CEO of your own permaculture business, you probably mostly deal with, you know, large projects. So why did you want to write a book about home permaculture?
You know, it's interesting. I would say at Shades of Green Permaculture, we're regenerative landscape design, installation, maintenance, organic lawn care, and education firm based here in Atlanta. And we actually, I would say about 75% of our projects are residential in scale. We also work with municipalities and institutions, nonprofits, schools, new developments, kind of the whole range beyond residential. But the thing that makes me feel really passionate about residential design is that most people have a piece of yard that they're stewarding, and how we do that and the choices we make in our landscapes really can add up to a lot of impact. So I think there's a lot of leverage that we have at the residential scale that gets me really excited.
Yeah, I really love that, because I think sometimes we don't really think about it that way, but that's a really good way of thinking about, we're just taking care of this little piece of land for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, could you share the story of your childhood? Because you do talk about it in the introduction of your book, and it's really a stark contrast to the 2 locations where you grew up.
Yeah, thank you for asking about that. I would say it's definitely the origin story, both of me, obviously, and this work that I kind of came into in my life. But I grew up between Western North Carolina, where my dad's side of the family is, and my dad and all of that side of my family lives there, and South Florida, where my mom and my stepdad were farmers. They grew plants for ornamental nursery business and also had a seed farm. My mom and my dad divorced when I was really young, maybe 2 years old. So I grew up kind of going back and forth between the two places. And when I was really young, maybe late elementary school or mid elementary school, my mom and stepdad started developing allergies to the kind of really moderately, you know, or minimally regulated pesticides and herbicides that they were spraying in the nursery. What was happening is they were, you know, they were using hot or protective suits, which makes sense. These spray
mm-hmm.
suits.
Sure.
But they're in South Florida. You know, it's 100,000% humidity.
Yeah.
It's so humid. And they're in the hot houses. So that's all the greenhouses. So it's extra humid, extra hot. And what would happen is these protective suits that they were wearing, when they would get wet from the inside, you know, from their sweat, which is inevitable, it would actually turn into more of a semi-permeable membrane. So the chemicals were getting trapped against their skin, you know, kind of into the suits and then trapped against their skin. So they had these rapidly accelerating, you know, life-threatening allergic reactions that started to develop. My stepdad, started by getting really swollen joints, and the doctors thought it was gout. or some sort of autoimmune disease. He was going and getting his knees and his ankles drained, you know, regularly because he couldn't really walk. He was in a wheelchair. He was getting nosebleeds that were lasting, you know, an hour, 2 hours at a time. So he was basically out of operations. And my mom took over doing the company business while he was trying to heal and figure out what was going on. And during that time, she started getting escalating reactions as well. So we lived in an area that our farm was 13 acres and a sea of probably thousands of acres of other nurseries with similar practices, spraying and all the things. And she would get these kind of allergic reactions that turned into anaphylactic shock, where her tongue would swell. And she was mostly able to manage it with Benadryl for a long time, but then they started getting worse. And the kind of straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, was she went to make a delivery at a nursery nearby, a seed delivery. And when she pulled the truck into their operations, like greenhouse, she smelled, you know, she got out of the car and she smelled immediately, oh, they just sprayed. So she got back in the car, rolled up the windows, turned on the, you know, no recirc on the air conditioning, took Benadryl. And then by the time they picked me up from school, going to the hospital, she was just in a full out anaphylactic reaction. So she was convulsing so hard that she shook the panels off the door and her hands were curling up and her tongue was, you know, she was choking on her tongue. And, you know, that was a very eye-opening experience as a child, I would say.
Yes.
I'm just like, wow. You know, and then you compare that to being in Western North Carolina, you know, spending the summers with my dad in this most beautiful, biodiverse, temperate rainforest on the planet, drinking spring water and going on wagon trains and camping in the woods. And it was just a very stark contrast to, you know, the canals that would drain all of the sludge out of South Florida that you couldn't even, you know, they smelled so bad. The kind of the perimeter of our nursery when I was a kid. It was just, you know, it's very, very visceral experience.
Mm-hmm. Quite an education. And I can see how that could definitely affect how you looked at this. So, and your folks are doing okay now, your mom and your stepfather.
Yeah, they're doing great. I think I was in eighth grade. We moved to the middle of nowhere in North Florida, and they're on 40 acres, and they just went through a 7-year detox, everything all organic, you know, no spraying, out of South Florida where they do aerial, you know, pest control, mosquito spraying, you know, weekly. Mm. And we're able to just kind of get away from a lot of the environmental toxin load and go through. You know, they still have some issues that are a result of it, but for the most part, they're really healthy now.
Well, that's great. And a good example, obviously, for this. So now let's get back to permaculture. And as you write in your book, it's a little bit, you know, hard to define what exactly that is. Can you, you know, simplify it a little bit for the listeners?
Yeah. So, yeah, if you were to YouTube it or read a book, there's a million different definitions. But the one that I really like to think about with permaculture is that it's an applied design science that embodies the ethics of nature. So the way this actually looks is I define it as sort of the three pillars of a regenerative landscape, or the three pillars of a permaculture landscape, which are working with water as a resource, you know, building biodiversity through plant communities that serve multiple functions, and treating waste, integrating waste as a resource to build soil fertility and to start to close the loops on our system. So if we're doing those three things in our landscape, there are a lot of ways, a lot of techniques that you can do to implement each of those three pillars. But if we're doing those three things, we're doing permaculture.
Okay. And then the term regenerative landscaping, do you consider that different, or is that just another name for the same thing?
You know, this is a really interesting question. I've been thinking about this a lot. Like, I think especially in the world of, you know, landscaping and permaculture and organic agriculture and sustainable, labels can be kind of a moving target.
Sure. Yeah.
You know? But ultimately, I use permaculture and regenerative interchangeably. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I throw in ecological landscaping as well. Mm-hmm. And I think it really depends on what the end goal is, what term you would use and what would maybe be the most appropriate. But regenerative from the perspective of everything that we're doing is looking to close loops on site. So when we're talking about water, we're rather than sending water to the stormwater system and then turning on a tap to irrigate, we're looking at ways that we can sink water into the soil and recharge our groundwater and ultimately our aquifers, you know, that we can passively irrigate the landscape using our topography and, you know, dancing the water through the land so it's useful where we want it. In managing soil, it's really about, you know, integrating things like our leaves and our compost. And, you know, there's a number of ways that we can kind of close the loops when it comes to soil on our site. And then with plants, it's really about building plant communities and closing the loops from the perspective of growing food and growing habitat and bolstering biodiversity and, you know, utilizing the root structures of plants so that they're doing different jobs in your landscape and the functions of plants so that they're doing different jobs in your landscape, that ultimately those things are what build resilience. And resilience is the end aim, you mm-hmm. know, of regenerative design and permaculture and ecological design.
Yes. Excellent. Well said. I think you've talked about this a number of times. I think I think a lot of times people think about permaculture and like, oh, well, that means we have to grow all our own food, right? And that mm-hmm. really doesn't necessarily is the case, is it?
No, it's not. And I think that, you know, that's kind of the legacy is really, you know, I think permaculture started with this inquiry of people have been living in harmony with natural systems and nature for millennia. And as Westerners and, you know, post-industrial society, we've kind of veered off course from that. Mm-hmm. But what are the things that we can do to reintegrate ourselves into nature, essentially? And, you know, food is a really big part of that. So I think, you know, the genesis of permaculture was really about how do we grow all of our own food? And one expression of that, as you see it out in the world, is this idea that we have to be living fully off-grid and we have to be self-sustaining and we have to grow all of our own food. And, you know, when you look to nature, I think that's like a little misguided, because when you look to nature, nothing is in a vacuum. Nothing is self-sustaining. Everything is integrated and collaborative, you know, mm-hmm. to some degree or another within natural systems. So I think ultimately it's really about how we do that. It doesn't necessarily need to be about growing food. It's really about the end goal, you mm-hmm. know, and are we implementing these pillars? Are we working with water? Are we building soil? And are we boosting biodiversity and meeting multiple functions? And one of those functions is human food, you know, but there
sure.
I've identified in the book, I talk about 12 other functions aside from food that plants can serve in your landscape. So,
and we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a bit. Our guest is Brandi Hall. She's the author of the book, The Complete Guide to Home Permaculture, How to Transform Your Yard into a Thriving and Productive Ecosystem. What questions do you have about regenerative gardening? Join in by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Stay with us in the second hour of the show today. We'll be talking about planning your garden so that it adapts as you age. And right now we're talking about permaculture, and especially creating permaculture in more of an urban setting. And Brandi Hall, what are some of the challenges that city dwellers deal with when it comes to making their gardens more eco-friendly?
These are really great questions you have.
Oh, thank you. We try.
Wonderful. Yeah, I mean, they vary somewhat depending on climate, but I think, you know, one that is maybe a universal thread are just the regulations and how, you know, I think the perception of how people think a regenerative garden needs to look or a permaculture garden needs to look versus what it can look like in actuality, you know, and I think the aesthetic beauty is a function of it being a healthy, vibrant living system. And there are a lot of design principles that we can implement to help it feel more manicured and curated and legible to the, you know, the average viewer. When you're not a person who knows what every plant is and why it's useful, you know, you want to, beauty is sort of a, I think it becomes a cue to care. So when we see landscapes that are maintained in a beautiful way, or we experience beauty, we want to interact with it more. So, you know, we see some of the challenges in sort of the suburban urban world are regulations like in HOAs, where there's mandates for a certain, you know, amount of lawn space and a certain amount of evergreen plantings or a certain amount of deciduous or flowering plants. And so those don't need to necessarily be challenges. They're just design constraints is how we think of them. So there are so many incredible plants that we can use as evergreens that are also edible and pollinator friendly and, you know, maybe have fruits or provide privacy screening or foundation plants, things like that. There are lots of ways that we can work with our lawns to make them healthier and still preserve lawn space, you know, open space. So I would say that's one challenge. And then another that is becoming, depending on the climate, in the Southeast where I'm located, stormwater is a really major issue. And I think this is becoming more ubiquitous across the country as we experience periods of long drought and then really intense rainfall. So working with stormwater in a way that can help to kind of mitigate those drought and flood kind of extremes where we're sinking the water into the soil while we have it, you know, when it's the rainy season, not needing to irrigate as frequently when it's dry because we've stored the water in the soil, so to speak. That's really beneficial on the homeowner side of things. And then I think cities are really starting to catch on to that, because managing large volumes of stormwater in heavy rain events becomes more and more costly if we're trying to do it just through our stormwater infrastructure. So the way things typically work in the built world is, you know, you have a roof, the downspout runs to maybe the driveway or a sidewalk, and the sidewalk drives to the driveway, and the driveway runs to the street, and the street runs to the stormwater drain, and the stormwater drain runs to the creek. And what happens is that water doesn't actually come in contact with any soil, you know, until it's in the creek. And there's a large volume, you know, the creeks swell when we have even smaller rain events at this point. And then also our stormwater, you know, infrastructure gets inundated because it can't carry that much water at a time, the more development we have. And so cities are constantly playing this game of needing to upsize, you know, for the next 20 years. And then that's a, you know, multi-million dollar project to do. And then they do it again 20 years later. And so I think they're starting to kind of catch on that it's a lot less expensive if we have builders and homeowners manage a percentage of their water in their own landscape before it ever enters the stormwater system. So,
yeah, and then a week later, then we have to turn the hose on and water, because
exactly.
We didn't keep any of that water. So it's a win-win for everybody to keep these things
in
mind.
It really is.
Yeah, for sure. So if we look into the book in particular, as you said, you're kind of divided into four sections. Let's break that down just a little bit. And again, if you have any questions about anything relating to this, please give us a call, 800-642-1234. If you're shy, you can send us an email. That's talk@wpr.org. I don't know what I'm talking about half the time. It's Friday. Give me a break. Okay. Ooh. So anyway, let's talk about the water cycle like we were talking about here. And I have to say, Brandy, I have looked at a lot of books in my life on gardening. Mm-hmm. This one does the water thing so well, and it's clear. The illustrations are amazing. You have so many options. I was really impressed. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, anybody that is interested in trying to figure out how to save some of this water, I really recommend you take a look at this book. So there's some ways that we can keep it in our gardens. So you broke it down into a few of those. So let's kind of cover them over like broadly, and then let's break them down. So let's talk about swales first.
Yeah. So earthworks are kind of one category of how we can keep water. And what that means is we're sort of sculpting the land in order to retain more water or to drain it, move it. You know, we're using the land as sort of the water infrastructure. So in swales, there's two types of swales that I talk about in the book. There's contoured swales, which are the kind that are most often referenced in permaculture literature when you're reading about them. But these are basically every point on that swale is at the same elevation. So it's running along the topography, perpendicular to the slope. And essentially, a swale is just a fancy name for a ditch with a berm. So we excavate the soil uphill and we berm it on the downhill side. Even if it's a micro hill, you know, this can still work in perceptively flat areas, as long as there's a tiny bit of grade. But essentially what we're doing with a contoured swale is we're taking the water that is coming down a slope and we're spreading it out horizontally along the slope. So we're able to slow it down that way and we're able to sink it into the soil. So anytime we can kind of add these sort of speed bumps into the water's path as we're building, then we're able to kind of slow it down so it's not carrying our soil away and it's not running off into the street, you know. So slowing it down. The other type of swale is a diversion swale. And these are essentially channels that we make in order to move the water from one spot to another. So an example of this would be a dry creek bed. You might see frequently, you know, and those are
sure.
kind of taking water from one place and trying to get it to go somewhere else. And the benefit of those is you don't always want to sink water, you know, it depends on your topography. You don't want to sink it too close to your house, or maybe that's a space that you have, some yard space for your children or your dog, or, you know, there are a number of reasons why you might not want to sink water somewhere. So so if that's the case, you can kind of direct it elsewhere and then, you know, use it where it's useful.
Mm-hmm.
And then, keep going. Sorry.
No, go ahead. I was just agreeing with you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So within earthworks, you know, we've got swales, which are diversion and contoured swales. And then the other kind of big category of earthworks are rain gardens. And so rain gardens are essentially bowls that we create in the land, and then we take that excavated soil and we build up a berm around it that's level. And this is a great way to capture water that you can direct into it. So like our downspouts or overflow from a rainwater cistern might go into a rain garden. And then rain gardens are filled with a gravel base that has a lot of void space where it can hold a volume of water. And then it's got an engineered soil mix, which is essentially just a compost sand mix. So it's pervious, but it's a growing medium. And then they're fully planted. So they look sort of like a low depression garden bed. But they're designed to be able to take on a lot of water at a time, and then they slowly sink into the soil around them. They're different from ponds in that they're not designed to hold water for more than about the longest I've seen them in Georgia when, you know, we have super heavy clay that doesn't drain very quickly. It's been about an hour or 12 hours where they'll hold water, but then they fully drain out.
How do you decide which one to use?
You know, it depends. So if you're managing, if you're working with a lot of overground water, a great way to do that is to use a contoured swale. And from there, you can have the swale lead to a pipe. And once you can get it into a pipe, a rain garden is a really good solution. And those can be a little bit smaller footprint, and you can put them, you know, they're more agile within the landscape in terms of how you're circulating and, you know, using the space and being able to put them into garden beds, you know, larger garden beds that are not rain gardens. But that's usually how we use them. We might use a diversion or a contoured swale or a divergent swale to get the water ultimately to a pipe and then put that piped water into a rain garden. We also use rain gardens a lot, as I was mentioning before, as a way of taking downspout water and sinking it into the soil. And then you can think of them almost like an ice cube tray. So if you were to tilt an ice cube tray under a stream of water, you see the top cells fill up first, and then those overflow, and those cascade and overflow. It's really similar with rain gardens. You fill one up, and then it's got an overflow pipe, and you can go to the next one and the next one. And this gives you a controlled way of moving the water through the landscape where it's going to be the most useful, not just to the plants that are in the rain garden itself, but the surrounding plants. If you have fruit trees, berry bushes, any kind of, you know, tree or shrub, perennials are going to benefit from that additional water.
Okay. Now the next thing that we're going to talk about a little bit is the rainwater harvesting. And we're familiar with rain barrels, but you go even further into the cistern system. So let's start with a rain barrel, and then if you could just go a little further with the cistern systems.
Great. Yeah, rain barrels are wonderful. You know, they hold about 50 to 75 gallons. Everybody's familiar with rain barrels, probably. Usually you see them kind of up against the house, connected to a downspout. The challenge with rain barrels a lot of times is they have an overflow that's really undersized, and so they fill up really quickly. You know, if you just to give you a sense of the volume of water that comes off a roof. So in the U.S., the average roof size is about 2,000 square feet. So in a 1-inch rain on 1,000 square feet, we have 622 gallons of water that runs off of just that, you know, half of a average American house. So when you have a rain barrel that's only 50 gallons, probably a lot of listeners have experienced this, if you have a rain barrel, where it fills up really quickly and then it starts overflowing out of the top.
Yes.
<You know. laughs> Yeah. Yep. If you're like me, when I moved into my house, it had a rain barrel, and every time it would fill up, it would actually go into the basement.
Oh,
because it was right against the
right
foundation.
There. Yep,
so,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the first things I did is I took the overflow. So going back to that, the overflow is often really undersized. It's only like an inch, maybe.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But you've got a 3-inch downspout going into it, you know, so that becomes the bottleneck, and then it just spews out of the top. So if you're going to have a rain barrel, I highly suggest having the overflow size match the input size, which would be about 3 inches probably. And then you can direct that elsewhere. But going back to your original question, we typically use cisterns. And the difference really, a rain barrel is a type of cistern, but most, you know, cisterns that we use are going to be at least 300 gallons. And that really relates to just the amount of water that a roof produces. And, you know, how you're going to use that water. So we would go up to, the smallest we would do is a 500-gallon cistern if we're going to do any sort of submersible pump for irrigation. So ultimately, what's going to determine the size of your catchment is how you intend to use it. You know, the rain barrel at my house, I use it as a foot wash. When I'm dirty, I use it as a place to wash my hand tools, to water my cats that are outside, you know. Things like that. My daughter loves to fill up buckets and just, you know, water our potted plants, things like that. But if you're going to do a cistern with an irrigation system, you know, you could do a rain-fed irrigation system pretty simply. I describe it in the book, but those we would want to be about 500 gallons. And that relates to just how much water you need for a submersible pump. And the other thing you can do with cisterns that I describe in the book is an inverted siphon system. So often when we think about rainwater harvesting, we imagine like it has to be right up against the house because that's where the downspout is. but we can actually use the principle of a water level. If listeners are familiar with a water level, where you fill a clear tube with water and it's going to find its own level. And if you drop that one side, it kind of comes out the other end, the dropped end.
Right.
So you can use that same principle with where you place cisterns. So you can seal a pipe that from your downspout and then run that underground and then have that outflow of that be lower than where you seal the pipe at the house. And it can feed by gravity, you know, fully gravity fed system into a tank. So that gives you some leeway and some wiggle room for where you place the cistern. Because one of the concerns people have sometimes is, well, I like the idea of rainwater harvesting, but it looks kind of ugly, or I don't really want that next to my house. So that solves the issue.
There you go. And the issue here in Wisconsin, winter. So what happens with our cistern system when it starts getting cold out?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you always, even in my climate, we always put a winter drain on the downspouts if we're doing that kind of cistern where it's inverted siphon is what that's called. And that basically the water, there's always going to be water in the pipe up to the level of the input on the tank. So a winter drain basically just allows, it's at the lowest point of that system. You would just turn a valve in the winter and it drains out the pipe, out the pipes. So you don't have that problem. You know, the depth of the pipes is obviously going to be very different depending on your climate. And then in terms of the pumps, you know, they're made to be able, if you have a thermal mass of water, it depends on the size of the tank. This is an argument for a larger tank in colder climates.
Sure.
Because if you have a larger thermal mass of water, the pump won't freeze. But a lot of people in cold climates will just turn the whole system off during the winter and drain the tank and drain the pump, drain the downspouts, and then have an alternate route for those downspouts. So you might have a valve where they can either feed a tank or just go straight to a rain garden.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense. Our guest today is Brandy Hall. She's the author of the book, The Complete Guide to Home Permaculture, How to Transform Your Yard into a Thriving and Productive Ecosystem. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us again Monday. Larry's going to be back to talk about the history of the earth in 1 hour with the author of a new book. And we're going to have a lone weather guy with us. Steve Ackerman will be with us to talk about the latest study on global warming. Always fun to have a weather guy with us. Right now, we are talking about permaculture. And Brandy, we have a call from Sarah in Appleton. Go right ahead, Sarah.
Hi, this is an extremely timely show because I am just starting to build a garden in my backyard and landscape my yard, and I'm very interested in this collaborative growing and making sure that everything's sort of beneficial to the environment. One question I have is with rainwater collection. I've been reading a little bit about how you don't want to collect it off of your roof because of animal feces and the chemicals that come off shingles and all that kind of stuff. And I'm wondering if you have any ideas for another way to collect rainwater to use in a garden that doesn't come from the roof.
Great question, Sarah, and congratulations on starting your landscape design. I would say there was a study out of the University of Texas not that long ago, maybe 5 years, maybe a little longer, studying the quality of rainwater, and they found of rainwater specifically collected from different roof surfaces. And what they found was that actually, you know, there's a little bit of chemical runoff that happens immediately after a brand new roof comes on to a house, which usually dissipates within a few months after there's been a few rains. After that point, it's really negligible the amount of chemicals that end up in the water from asphalt shingle roofs specifically. It was very similar, you know, a negligible, statistically insignificant amount differing from like a metal roof per se. And then in terms of, you know, animal feces and other things, that's actually effluent that is beneficial so long as you're just putting it right in the soil. You know, I wouldn't use that water to irrigate, not necessarily to irrigate, but I wouldn't use that water to water leafy greens or something you're about to eat raw and then eat it right then. But so long as you're using that water just to sink it right into the soil, I would say it's actually not problematic. But the big question is, how do you intend to use the water ultimately? Is it for irrigation? Is it for, you know, if it's a potable water system, that's obviously a very different set of filters and, you know, things that need to be considered. But yeah, that's a great question. Thank you.
Sarah, did you have any follow-up on that, or is that good?
Helpful, and I do intend to use. I intend to grow vegetables in a specific area, and I will just not use any rainwater collected from the roof to water the vegetables. That's great.
Yeah, or if you do, put it into a drip irrigation system, you know, and put that subsoil so that the water is just going into the soil, because it's not; those aren't going to be uptaken into the leaves. But if you were to top, you know, foliar watering where it's actually just getting on the leaves, I think there would be more of a, you know, a potential for specifically the, you know, the feces you were speaking to.
And that's a better way to do it anyway. It's easier.
Exactly.
It's easier and you're less likely to get, you know, diseases and things. So good luck, Sarah. That's so exciting. So check in. Let us know how you're doing up there in Appleton. So we talked about the water portion. Let's get going to the soil because we're running out of time and you still have a couple areas to cover. So let's go to soil. You know, our soil, it's so important. And we've been lately talking a lot more about, you know, getting that healthy soil. We kind of forget about it sometimes, but what's the role of healthy soil in a resilient landscape?
That's a really good question. So healthy soil means more nutrients to the plants. It means when we think about a whole system, healthy soil, for the way we think about it at Shades of Green, is it's really about increasing the carbon content in your soil or the organic material in your soil. So that plays into, you know, root health and being able to actually navigate the soil. It plays into the sponge that is created through soil, which helps with the drought and flood kind of, you know, extremes that we've been talking about with water. So those are very connected. And then, you know, soil also plays a lot into plant health and having the right nutrients in your soil and the right pH and, you know, a lot of microbes and beneficial organisms are part, you know, a lot of beneficial organisms, their life cycle, part of the life cycle is in the soil if they're above ground or, you know, have play some role in the uptake and conveyance of nutrients. So soil is essential. You know, it's the obvious building block of the plant world, and how that interfaces with water is really an important piece of the puzzle.
So, you know, what does a healthy soil look like is when you actually look at it? Because, I mean, when I look at urban soil, a lot of times I don't see soil, I see dirt. It's nasty looking. So what should a healthy soil look like?
You know, it's interesting because in urban settings, a lot of why our soil is so unhealthy looking is because a lot of the topsoil has been scraped and we're left with sort of that subsoil layer, which here in Georgia, you see a lot of red clay. It doesn't have any organic material in it. And so a healthy soil is going to look a little, it's going to look a little lighter. It's going to be able to hold water so you can wet it and you can squeeze it and you'll have the water will hold in it and it'll also come, you know, do some dripping. And it really depends on the soil profile. It's not going to be the same in every climate, but a really good rule of thumb is that it's going to have a lot of organic material. So it's going to have that fluff. But then, you know, the plants that you use also play into the soil. So for instance, people love to talk a lot about how bad Georgia clay is, or just clay is just so bad, right? Mm-hmm. We hear that all the time, but clay is actually super mineral rich, but it's that those minerals aren't really uptakeable by the plants So when we increase the organic material in the soil, we're actually making it so that those nutrients are more available to the plants. And it's going to differ also depending on what is growing. So if you're in a woodland, you know, a healthy soil is going to look like mycelium. You're going to see those little white sort of threads when you pick it up. You're going to see different horizons to it where the leaf litter is breaking down and then becomes, you know, more like fine particulates as you get lower into the soil. But if you're looking in a, you know, a more perennial-based kind of garden, maybe that's a little bit more full sun, the soil doesn't actually need to be as organic rich, or as mycelium rich. Those soils tend to be a little bit more bacteria heavy. A lot of our native species actually thrive in a little bit more, not distressed soils, but a little, what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, maybe slightly what we would look at and say, oh, that's kind of a distressed soil, or it's mm-hmm. not a super rich soil. But they stress can be an asset to a lot of our native prairie species, which is probably more applicable to y'all.
Yeah, there are some areas, and that's the point of planting natives, because that's the soil they like. Right?
Exactly. And it's not as much of an uphill battle. But I would say regardless of the soil type and regardless of, you know, your ecotype, building organic material in the soil is always going to be an essential piece of it. And, you know, adding different types of composts and nutrients. So you could do compost tea or worm castings or leaf litter, mushroom compost. There's so many. You want to go with like leaf litter and mushroom compost in more fungal rich environments. Those are your woodlands and your shrubs, shady gardens typically. And then your more bacteria rich soils are going to be in your sunnier, you know, perennial based gardens. So those are going to be your compost and your worm castings and those types of amendments.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that you want to kind of add to the conversation about soil that we should keep in mind when we're thinking about trying to make our gardens be a little bit more ecological?
Yeah. So like I said, always thinking about the organic material that we're adding, because soil is our sponge layer. It's the earth's sponge. So it really helps with the rainwater mitigation and also allowing it to actually recharge our groundwater stores and aquifers. And then when we're thinking about soil, it's also really important to just think about closing the loops. So when we're, you know, the example of leaves is a really great one. So in the fall, so many people will just blow their leaves and bag them and then set them on the curb, and then they go to the landfill. And then in the spring, we go buy bags of compost from the store that maybe were shipped from California, you know?
Yes.
And so it's like a prime example of a linear system and an exact example of how we can close it. So, you know, leaving the leaves, it's not only beneficial for the soil, but that's where like fireflies overwinter. You know, if you want to have fireflies,
right,
leaving the leaves is a really important part, and it's beneficial for the soil. So, you know, that's a great example of just how we can think that way in our own landscapes.
Mm-hmm. I have lots of leaves mulching my shrubs and plants mm-hmm. right now. My hardest part is figuring out when is it okay to kind of disturb those, because who knows what's underneath. So,
yeah. For y'all, it falls in line with like the no-mo. Here it's no-mo March is what we say.
Yeah.
Everything's still sort of like overwintering, and you want to wait until it flowers a little
mm-hmm.
bit. Same there, but it's usually no-mo May, I think, for y'all.
Yeah, that's even a little late these days. It's so difficult to figure it out these days. So we've had three springs so far. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we're in the real spring now.
I hope not. Probably not. Today's chilly. Tomorrow it's going to be warmer. And then it's, you never know. You just have to take precautions. So,
yeah, exactly. We're layers.
Yeah, exactly. Layers is the key. Same thing for your plants. Layers right now are very important. So one of the titles in your book is called The Problem with Conventional Plant Choices. And I like that. Why is it a problem?
Yeah. So I'm a big believer in, before you can actually solve something, you have to understand what the issue is.
Uh-huh.
So in conventional plant choices, we're often prioritizing the aesthetic over everything else. Like, okay, I want symmetry on the foundation of my house. And so therefore I'm going to use, you know, a boxwood across the board, right? But the way you, maybe you have a shade tree in the front yard and the left half of your house is sunny and the right half of your house is shady, and that one plant is not going to singularly thrive, mm-hmm. right? Because our landscapes are full of microclimates. And so one big problem with the conventional landscaping plants that we use is it's very focused on the aesthetic and not necessarily focused on what's the right plant for this space. So that's where, like you've mentioned before, planting native plants is a huge, of huge importance because of not just its, you know, how much different native plants have co-evolved with beneficial insects and the soils and the rainfall and the, you know, the frost days and all of the things. They're well adapted. They're well adapted to live in the climates where they evolve.
Mm-hmm.
And they require a lot less inputs. And then also when you're thinking about a landscape, rather than thinking that it's just, oh, this is a one-size-fits-all situation, you know, you see this a lot with grass where people try to be growing a monoculture of grass, meaning just one species, but the soil profile and the water profile and the light profile of different spaces in your yard are going to be different. And so you might have it thriving over here, but then it's always a little fungal or patchy on this other side.
Right.
And rather than fighting those conditions, we can think of diversifying our lawns so that we have many species, and the ones that do well in the shade are going to thrive in that little patchy spot. And, you know, the ones that like the hot, dry are going to thrive over in the sunny spot. And we're not thinking of it as a sort of like uniform condition, you know, and that solves a lot of problems just in and of itself. But then the other kind of issue with conventional plant choices most of the time is that there are a lot of plants that are bred just for their aesthetic value tend to be less disease resistant. You know, so you're going to have more pests and diseases in your landscape. And then the watering, you know, they're not necessarily suited for our climates. So you go to just the hardware store and you get some Monrovia plants. You know, those were grown wherever they were grown, Oregon or whatever. And it's not the same climate. And it's, you know, they're cultivars that are going to be more susceptible to fungus and pests. So that introduces more problems than you need, you know, and that can be solved by diversifying and using regionally appropriate and native plants. And then the irrigation piece, you know, I think we could spend a whole day just talking about lawns, but one of the notable things about lawns is that as we do them most of the time in this country, they require a lot of inputs. They require a lot of fertilization, and that becomes runoff and impairs our streams. You know, there's a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico that's the size of Connecticut because of all the pesticide and herbicide runoff, you know, that comes out of the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
So when we think about irrigation too, you know, lawns require a lot of irrigation when we're trying to grow just a monoculture. I think the EPA published a study years ago that said 2/3 of all water use in the United States is for irrigating lawns, and that includes croplands.
Yeah, well, that's a great place to end right there, Brandy. I think that's definitely evidence right there that we should all kind of look into this type of change in our gardens. And I appreciate so much for you sharing your information with us and your expertise. So I'd love to have you come back again.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the thoughtful conversation and for reading the book. And,
you bet.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've been talking to Brandy Hall, the author of the book, The Complete Guide to Home Permaculture, How to Transform Your Yard into a Thriving and Productive Ecosystem. Take a look at it. You will definitely benefit from it.